Profile Interview.
23 minutes after 9 o'clock, I'm joined by Terry Angelos on her latest release, book release, White Trash. Terry, thank you so much for joining us, and my apologies for taking this interview a little later than I would. But what do you make of this big debate around vaccines, vaxxers, anti-vaxxers?
Good evening, Aubrey. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear, Terry.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having a chat with me this evening.
Sure.
Gosh, it's something that I think seems to be very polarizing.
Indeed.
I've been vaccinated myself, and I am just trusting in medicine and science, and that this seems to be the best way forward.
Yep.
As a self-employed person, I'm definitely relying on the economy opening up.
Yeah. Listen, I want to talk about your book, White Trash.
Yes.
And even before we start the conversation, perhaps even about the content of the book and the process that you've gone through, would you change things if you had the opportunity and the way that they've happened? I know that part of the reason why you waited until you could speak to your children to be part of the decision as to whether or not the book would be published, because I know that you started writing the book piecemeal a long time ago and waited for the moment when your children would be able to engage with the issues. And I imagine that the reason why the book has now been published is because your children have said, yes, Mom, go ahead and do this. But would you, and I'm starting right at the end, would you change things, Terry?
Change things in terms of writing
In terms of the life that led to this point?
In terms of the life? That's a great question, and one I've asked myself quite a number of times. I think, we all want to look back on our lives and see we could have avoided painful experiences or mistakes that have left us with feelings of shame. But at the same time, I don't think I'd be where I am right now, which is, with a really wonderful family and a great marriage and, a deep sense of purpose and spirituality, and just kind of, the things that come about when you've had life experiences, when you've taken risks.
You have interestingly given this book the name White Trash.
Yes.
Why?
Yeah, my family's been asking the same question. It hasn't gone down very well with everybody, and I had a couple of other working titles, and they just felt obscure. And I was just trying to figure out what is the best way to present all the different layers and themes that all intersect in this book. And I just had a light bulb moment, and the word white trash popped into my head. And it was one of those moments where the minute I thought of it, I just got goosebumps, and I knew that this was the right title, as uncomfortable and as loaded as it is. It just felt like the right intersection of all the layers of the book, because the hook of the book is obviously my year as a high-class pool girl, but it's quite layered with other themes that I had really wanted to tackle in writing the memoir, and I felt like it was a multi-layered title.
It's certainly a multi-layered title, but it's also a title that gives the impression that you have given some sort of value judgment to your life, that you've judged yourself in a particular way. Would that be a fair observation?
Yes, I think definitely, the way I when I got to a point of really wanting to turn away from the choices I'd made and had kind of gone down this rabbit hole, it was a combination of curiosity and adventure and all kinds of things that I did feel broken. I did feel like I had, you know, trashed my life, that all the opportunities and all the things that had come my way, I'd kind of taken them and really made a big mess of things. So it is in that sense. And I think the resolution of the book is coming to a point where, you know, my judgment on myself is that I'm treasure and I'm treasured, the very opposite of trash. Mm. But I wanted to also take on that kind of, you know, the intimation of a very strong racial slur, which is kind of because dealing with my racial identity is also, you know, really woven into the book as well.
Yeah. One of the things that comes out of the reviews and, you know, people I've talked to about the book is that you very, very courageously, I don't want to say boldly, but definitely courageously deal with issues of your race. The fact that you came and, you know, came from war-torn Rhodesia at the time as an 11-year-old coming into South Africa, dealing with issues of race that we are still grappling with as a society. What are some of those issues that you point to in this process that you go through? And dare I say, a redemptive process. But we'll get into that. What are some of those issues that you pull out of and that seem to be quite evident in the title of the book, White Trash?
Yeah, thank you, Aubrey. I think when I tried to think about how to write my story, I couldn't do it without addressing the issues of race. And I think one of the things that I wanted to kind of tackle was just to talk about how our worldview is shaped and what it means to start unraveling that worldview, that you know, the propaganda, the way, you know, the lies that we grow up with, and the way that our worldview is kind of shaped. I wanted to take someone into that interior landscape, as ugly, you know, as ugly and painful and shameful as it was, and to also just present this idea that I think a lot of white people really struggle with is this idea that good people can't be racist. And so, you know, when you read the book, you'll see that I talk about coming from, you know, a good home, a privileged home, very middle class. My parents were teachers, good education, great opportunities, and surrounded by, you know, what most people would consider themselves to be good citizens. And so I just really wanted to unpack that, because I think it's easy, and again, this refers back to the title, it's easy to think of white supremacists as being, you know, the stereotypical
skinheads,
you know, in the white vest with the swastika tattooed on the, you know, and we kind of have these stereotypes. And so it's always the other, it's always them. And, you know, I wanted, it's been hugely risky and probably as difficult, if not more difficult, writing about racial identity than about writing about being a call girl. The risk in that is huge. And honestly, I actually stalled the book for about 2 or 3 years because I just felt like, oh gosh, I'm just walking into such a quagmire here. And it was really difficult to navigate. But in the end of it, I'm really, you know, I've taken that risk. And you know, I think I'm hoping that it will lead to some great discussion, and that, you know, the honesty will kind of set a tone for other people to have great conversations that are just honest.
The book is a real study into the virtue of honesty. I mean, here is a woman who, you know, here's a woman who who's made a decent life for herself in South Africa. You could have decided to shut up and never talk about the fact that at some point in your life you were a call girl. while you were speaking, you got hooked up on the word hook, and I thought to myself, do I ask the question as it comes to my mind, or do I try to find better euphemisms? But I'm going to go for the risque. you were fundamentally a hooker, right? And that very admission to the point where you can write about it in the context of somebody who had escaped it makes me want to ask a whole lot of questions. And you've already said that the book is many layered, that there's so many layers to it. But the anchor story here is about, here's a woman who didn't have to tell us the story, but made the effort to write the story, but not only write the story, but is brutally honest about the goings on. Why would you, when you've escaped, Terry, when you've made it, as it were, why do you need to tell the story of a very sordid period in your life?
Aubrey, I suppose everyone that's ever birthed a story, just it's in them and they need to get it out. And so it was just one of those things where it felt like a calling. I felt like I can just pack that all away and never talk about it. But I think there's a lot of healing that happens in storytelling. And although I'd done a lot of therapy and a lot of, you know, it's 32 years ago, for goodness, you know, one would hope that I've recovered and moved on and, like you say, built a good life. So why dig it up? But, you know, there were two things. The one is that shaping your trauma into a story is incredibly healing. And I found it surprisingly liberating, in fact, to completely expose myself. It's terrifying. You know, it's like running around naked all the time now. You know, when I see the story splashed everywhere, I'm like, oh, you know, gosh, what have I done? But at the same time, it is liberating. The other thing was, I think that I wanted almost to actually investigate my own kind of the trajectory of how did I get from, you know, good home, middle class, private school education, blah, blah, blah. How did I get from there to there? Because that was, I think, where a lot of my own shame rested, was in that question. But I think also just hoping that the story will connect with many people. And I think shame is one of the most toxic and debilitating emotions that we, you know, that we grapple with as human beings. And, you know, when shame is met with compassion, that's incredibly, that's just incredibly powerful and incredibly healing. And so,
I hear you, and part of me wants to say, but there's something else there besides you. There's your children and your husband. So Terry didn't just take herself on this journey. She is connected inextricably so to her children, their identities, their you know, life trajectories. Her husband, how have they been with this? I know that I started off with that question, but how have they been with this as it becomes practical and real? I imagine that while it's still a concept, while it's still something you discuss around the table and the cerebral sort of things that take place in that conversation, it has one dimension. But once it is splashed all over the place and you start speaking on radio and people start to pry into your life and the motivations for the things that you do, it becomes a totally different story. Tell me about that dimension, Terry. The family, it's all redemptive for you. It's all therapeutic for you. It's all healing for you. What about them?
Aubrey, it's not been an easy road, certainly with my husband. I think in the process of writing the book, I think just – you know, he obviously, we have no secrets, and he knew about my past, but there was obviously a lot more detail and a lot more specificity that came out. But, you know, we agreed to go on this journey together. And, you know, I wouldn't have done it if there wasn't support and buy-in from him.
Yeah.
The same with my children. I suppose, obviously, at the moment, we're in the midst of kind of the publicity of it all, you know. So, you know, I have had those moments where I've thought, oh, my goodness, you know, like you say, it's one thing in theory, and then when, you know, when the reality hits. My children, I waited for them to be out of school. I felt that the school environment would be very difficult for them to negotiate.
I understand that, yeah.
I've had many conversations. And I think what's been incredible was actually it's opened up a lot of conversation and dialogue. And, you know, I think I've always raised my children, and my approach to raising children has been to raise them to be autonomous and to think for themselves, to be independent. And for myself, motherhood is just one aspect of who I am. And so I think I've tried to raise very independent children. I've got two of them are overseas. The one is just studying his degree here in Durban, but I think we've had incredible conversation, and they've been very proud of me. I mean, they say, "We're so proud of you, Mom." They're supportive. They may not be ready to read the book. That I think they'll have to do when they are ready, and they may never read the book. Some of my family, my mom in particular, has, you know, this has been difficult for her to process. And I respect that. You know, not everyone that reads it is going to be reading it from the point of view of a mother, a child, a husband.
Of course.
But I knew that without their support, I wouldn't have gone through with it, the very close family.
011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567 if you've had a chance to read White Trash, a memoir by Terry Angelos. Am I pronouncing your surname properly?
Perfectly.
Thank you. Thank you, Terry. I try. one of the things that I envy you for is that you have now been in touch with places in your various relationships that few human beings ever get to. And that is the ability to be vulnerable enough to those that you love, to have your love tested in the way that it has been tested, and to come out on the other side. And I imagine that you have, particularly with your husband, and I'm speaking to you also as a man, having to read or hear this kind of content about my wife. I think that you and your husband are in an extremely unique place that many people will never, in fact, know about. That is really the place of true love. Because I sense that love is not just about the good times, but it is the blanket that covers us when things are cold and judgmental and hurtful and all of those kinds of things. So I envy you in that sense, that you've gone to that place, and very few people ever do in their lifetimes. I'm hoping that there will be a sequel to this book that will highlight perhaps some of those aspects. Is there a possibility that may happen?
Yes, well, now that I've written one book, I'm absolutely hooked, excuse the pun, but yep. I really love the process. I'm a visual artist, you know, in my full-time employ, and I really love the artistry and the crafts the craftsmanship of actually putting a book together and making it as engaging and gripping and beautiful and poetic and all of those things as possible. And yes, I think when you really show yourself in you know, warts and all, and are completely vulnerable, and you are still loved, that's a deeply secure love.
Yeah.
And coming from a place, you know, when I was during that time, I had become very adept at what I called shape shifting and wearing different masks.
Yes.
And being manipulative towards men and having power over men. So being in a relationship where I had to actually drop all of that weaponry, drop all of that armor. And, you know, over the years, through the ups and downs of life, I mean, it's not the only challenge I've faced in my marriage, 30 odd years of marriage, there's going to be some challenges. But the thing is, if you wrestle through them together and you put your trust that your vulnerability will be met with compassion and kindness, even when the person's finding it difficult, if they still can respond kindly and you wrestle your way through it, you do actually come to an incredible place on the other side. And it's messy and it's difficult when you're going through it. I mean, we did need to get some marriage counseling and we had to do a lot of talking through things. But it's been really worthwhile. I think just even if the book hadn't published, I think the process of kind of writing and wrestling through it all would have been really worthwhile.
Amongst the other themes that you explore is the issue of class. You talk about the fact that because you had a slightly different accent in some of the clubs that you would visit, the gentlemen's clubs that you would be a hostess at, the your accent was considered to be quite exotic in London. Because you spoke almost aristocratically. I think it's the sense that I got. Talk to me about that seedy environment and issues of class. You speak about the ability to manipulate situations, particularly men. But talk to me about the issue of class and how that became a part of your life. Part of what you manipulated in order to get through all of this?
Definitely. I think growing up in South Africa, our society was divided very much along racial lines. But when you go to a place like England, I think that was kind of, you know, one of the steps in kind of unlayering my social bias, my racial bias was, you know, that was the first time that I kind of interacted with men that were different to the black men that I had come across in South Africa. And so it was, you know, so through that, a lot of my own biases got addressed, but then realizing that, you know, you are seen on the wrong end of the class scale. And realizing that the society is divided along, you know, other lines. And my first experience of that was au pairing. And, you know, it didn't go down well with me because, my goodness me, I'm not here to do your ironing. Who do you think I am, kind of thing. So that experience of actually being, you know, I was 19 years old, you know, being sort of a private school educated white girl, suddenly, you know, being treated like the maid, you know, was very difficult for me. I was like, oh, I'm having none of this. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Was that
a part of the reason why your eyes were open to the race conversation?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I think going through, so as you go through the story, you'll definitely see incidences in which it confronts me and in which I have choices to make to change the way that I see things, to change my responses. And so it's kind of that that environment in London that is so multicultural, so multiracial, so multi-class structured, you know, was very confrontational for me. And, you know, the book's not political, but people definitely, you know, would kind of confront you on your political views coming from South Africa in the the late 1980s.
Yeah.
You know, and I just regurgitated back all the stuff that I had grown up with. You know, I hadn't learned to think for myself.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of things that were being confronted. And then kind of being, like you say, on the experience of someone who just saw you as nothing, as just a body, a hand, a mouth, you know, having no status at all, even though you think yourself you think you're somebody. And you then realize you are nothing, you are nobody. You can be discarded like a piece of trash to some of these men, and that your title, high class call girl, has got nothing to do with you and your standing in society. It's got everything to do with the clients. They're the ones that are high class. You nothing.
The work of a call girl, amongst other things, is to engage, I suppose, in sexual activity, which is a very intimate reality. I'm trying to sort of throw all of the things that you and I have spoken about into this melting pot of what would have been your experience. You would have probably have been exposed to clients from other races, clients that were probably very wealthy, but wealthy because of nefarious activities and crime. In fact, in some of the chapters, you do speak about a particular client. I think his name was Gecko. But some of them would have been of different races. You speak about the Chinese mafia, getting involved in the Chinese mafia. I don't want to give away too many things because I want people to read the book, right? But yeah. I'm looking at all of those experiences, the various layers of your experiences, your identity as it was being challenged, your identity as you understood it was being challenged. Here's a question, and you don't have to answer this question. But did you find yourself in a situation where you had a client who was of another race, and because of the narratives that you'd learned back home, had to say yes, but you didn't want to say yes to a deal?
I'll answer that question, and there's an incident in the book when I first arrived in London where a very attractive young black man tried to pick me up and ask me out, and I did go out with him, and I was curious, but found myself it always felt like a great taboo, more than a repulsion, never a repulsion, but more like something taboo. And I, you know, I did end up with clients from all races, and that there is a chapter on an incident with a black man. I've named all the kind of the incidences or the clients that I do write about have been named Crocodile, Stallion, to kind of just avoid names often, which I wouldn't remember. But it definitely had a profound impact on me. There was definitely an internal struggle. Actually a freeing of some kind, like breaking through a barrier, I suppose. But the best word I can think of is taboo. It was like, this is not something I'm supposed to do.
Was the taboo feeling greater for what you were doing versus whom you were doing it with?
Who?
So let me understand. So in your mind, let me say, in your South African mind, you had feelings of taboo that were more intense for the fact that you were with a black man rather than the fact that you were engaged in soliciting?
Probably both, but I think when you read through the childhood that I grew up in, there was definitely, you know, I talk about the Tokolosh, the boogeyman,
yeah,
the terrorist, all rolled into one. So I think, in my childhood mind, my sort of ideation of the black man had that very kind of, there was a degree of terror associated with it. Part of the social trauma of war. And I think the thing is that that's how we able to... that's how we kind of take on racial bias, is by demonizing the other, and by stereotyping. And it happens both ways. In fact, some of my black friends that have already written the book, said sometimes black people look at white people and they don't see real human beings. They just see the whiteness. And it's the same the other way around.
It's very true. It's very true. And it's got to do, as you say, with the way that we've all been conditioned in our various sort of places of origin,
exactly.
Right?
So it was kind of like a sleeping with the enemy kind of thing.
A betrayal sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So ultimately, and I'm watching my time because I there's so much I want to get. Ultimately, this is a reflection of a point in time in your life where ultimately you became a possession. Right, you were owned. I mean, you speak about the Chinese mafia and the fact that at some point you had to really do some major work in extricating yourself from that life, and there had to be some sort of bartering and so forth. And I imagine that what that would have done is that it would have made you lose your sense of humanity and perhaps start seeing yourself as a commodity. Did that ever happen?
Definitely. I found it to be very, ultimately very dehumanizing, initially empowering in a strange way, being a young girl, having lots of, earning unimaginable amounts of money, living in this beautiful penthouse, expensive dinners, expensive holidays. There was something about it that was quite seductive and intoxicating, and you sort of just push out that part of your brain that's telling you you've just crossed about 100 lines and you're really compromised whatever family values you've grown up with. But after that kind of honeymoon period, things for me definitely started to unravel. And, I think that's where I probably will differ with people who, are kind of, pro sex workers, pro legalization. That's probably a whole other subject that would take up another whole hour. But I think for me, it was very dehumanizing.
You mean the narrative that says that says, well, sex workers work, and we should be able to deal with it as we deal with other forms of work. You're suggesting that there's that debate is a bit simplistic.
Definitely, and I think, the tragedy is in a country like South Africa where there is so much inequality. There are just so many young girls who are vulnerable and who, for them, this is possibly the only viable option for any kind of financial security or stability or whatever. But, you know, when I did quite a lot of research around the topic, just comparing my experience to what, you know, what research has shown, and it was really very fascinating. But, you know, the kind of work that is involved in sex work actually requires, you know, they're saying you should actually go on hostage training. It's kind of security work. You would need the same kind of training as someone who does a high-level security job. How to hide a knife, how to not get strangled, how to get out of a hostage situation. And I had to become very, very adept at reading people, at, you know, being very aware of my surroundings.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's just so, yes, it's work, but look at the nature of the work.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and, Terry, and most girls...
You and I have run out of time, it's been such a fascinating conversation. There's a lot of people writing to me, and the tones are very judgmental and so forth. I urge them to read the book. It's called White Trash, a memoir of a high class call girl, which goes behind the scenes of that seedy life. Please get the book, White Trash. How do we find the book?
So the preferred bookseller is Exclusive Books, but it's also at Bargain Books. You can get it online from Loot, from Amazon. You can get it ebook, Kindle, or paperback. And yeah, I believe it's doing really well. People that have read it have loved it.
Let me read you some of the stuff that's coming through. Let me read it for you, and I'm not asking you to answer.
Do I want to hear this?
Yeah, but let me read some of the stuff that's come through. This one says, this woman never had to go through this. But then again, white people seem to want to always pander on struggles they absolutely have no business in. Okay? Think about that. This person says... weird questions. Are you asking for yourself? Yes, I am. I am asking for myself because I'm having this conversation with Terry myself. And that's a pretty weird question too. Are you asking for yourself? Finally, I want to say to you that all courage to you, Terry. All courage to you. And I really wish you all the best. I think that you have... entered a space where your story can help many of us in many different ways. And I want to thank you very much
I really hope so.
I want to thank you very much for your candor, and I hope that the book does well.